Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Green Room for Disrupt TV. And today, Bala Afshar is traveling, and I will be the solo host. But I'm here with an amazing co-host, my amazing producer, Elle. And of course, we've got three great guests here. So we're going to introduce them in reverse order of appearance. And of course, we will do that and ask them where they're coming in from and what are they talking about today. So, all right, Scott, where are you coming in from? What's the topic of du jour?
I am coming in from D.C., and I'm going to talk about what the Income to Support All Foundation, or its foundation for short, is up to, what projects we're up to, and how it's centered around the concept of universal or unconditional basic income.
All right. Conrad, where are you coming from? Nice palm trees.
I am at an Airbnb in Los Angeles today, traveling, working with Scott, actually, in the ITSA Foundation, and specifically on the two projects you can see in my name, Commingle and Bootstraps, around universal basic income.
Very cool. And of course, Sally, where are you coming in from? What are we talking about? Our return guest?
Great to be here. I'm coming in from Seville, Spain, where I'm on a one-month vacation, the first in about 10 years. So I'm in an Airbnb. And today I want to talk about the role of talent in pushing diversity and inclusion, why it's not going away. Also talk about culture and leadership and how it's often misunderstood, the connection.
Wonderful. Well, looking forward to talking to you more there. And thank you for starting your vacation with us. And really appreciate it. All right. Well, turn it over to you, Elle. Let's go through the count. And of course, kick off the show.
All right, 3, 2, 1.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Disrupt TV. As you can tell, we're on episode number 362, Bala Afshar's Untransit, and we'll join us on the next episode. More importantly, I'm Ray Wong. You're your co-host for the day and host for Disrupt TV. And of course, this is the show that interviews CEOs, thought leaders, academics, Thinkers 50 alums, and of course, some great ideas and of course, great entrepreneurs along the way. And of course, this week, we're going to kick it off with a return guest. Sally Huggison, author, speaker, and leadership coach. She's cited in Forbes as the world's premier expert on women's leadership, and she's an international best-selling author, speaker, and leadership coach. She's also been inducted in the Thinkers 50 Hall of Fame, one of our favorite lists. And of course, that's a list, and that's a group of special people that honors those whose ideas have shaped the field of leadership worldwide. She's also ranked number 3 among the world's thought leaders by Global Gurus. And of course, we saw her earlier with the latest book, Rising Together, How We Can Bridge Divides and Create a More Inclusive Workplace. And of course, this is a good book that talks about how you create inclusion, teams, relationships across workplaces. And of course, Rising Together, built on Sally's success in terms of How Women Rise, her book previously written with Marshall Goldsmith. And of course, a very, very insightful book. So for over 30 years, Sally's been around talking about seminars, workshops, and keynotes for companies. And now she's here on Disrupt TV talking about a very, very important issue. So welcome to the show, Sally.
Thank you, Ray. It's wonderful to be back with you again.
Well, happy to have you here. And today you want to talk a little bit more about topics around leadership, but more importantly about inclusion and how it's not going away as it relates to tech. So let's start here. You write that the present activism against DEI is not likely to affect corporate commitments in the long term. Why is that? And maybe perhaps it's the way we've defined DEI, but let's start there.
Well, I agree with you. How we've defined DEI is a big, is a part of this. But basically, I do not think that the push to find more inclusive ways of leading highly diverse organizations is going away because of demographic reality. All over the globe, companies have to draw from an ever more diverse talent pool. And the only way you can do that really successfully is by making people feel a part of, which is why diversity and inclusion are kind of intuitively paired. In addition, work is done in teams. And in order to work effectively in teams, we need to feel like a part of that team. When we feel separated from it, or not sure how we fit in, or do we really matter to the team, and how is our contribution seen, we cannot be as effective. So for all those reasons, inclusion has become a demographic necessity for organizations. And that's why I don't think it's going away. It's not a political issue. It is a demographic issue and a business issue.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting point, right? I was speaking to a friend and we were trying to identify what was happening. And a lot of the efforts were what we had called superficial diversity, things that you can't change, right? It could be your gender, it could be your race, it could be your set of beliefs, it could be your orientation, right? And what was happening was we were forgetting the basic principles. You want to start with, like, what are the values of a co-organization? What are the skills and experiences you bring to the table? And of course, what kind of degrees and other things that you have that are in place? And then you look at diversity and see what actually happens and where it lands. Right, you don't forget that you hire for those certain skills, but you also work to figure out how you make sure something is there. And we've seen a lot of controversy as to what's been going on in the American Medical Association in terms of how interns are being trained or are hired, or pilots, for example, right? And competency is still very, very important. And then we look at everything else. Are you seeing that shift in terms of the way those conversations are being made?
I am seeing a shift in how that conversation is, those conversations are happening. One of the things is we've been very narrow in our approaches to diversity. There's this group and there's that group. And as a result, and I think this is one of the things that has lost a lot of friends for diversity and inclusion, we've gotten very focused on language. So, well, we're calling this group this month or this year, we're no longer, I write. So I get notices from the publisher, here's a list of updated terms to call these different groups of people. Are you kidding me? That's not what matters. That's not what is important. Of course, you don't want to be offensive to people, but that's not the idea. Is how do we behave to people? How do we get comfortable with people who we know have different ideas, different backgrounds, different values? How does that happen? I'm always focused on the how in my work. And I think that some of that has been lost. And that's when the focus on language has made a lot of work in diversity and inclusion be perceived of as a kind of political correctness that when it's done well, it should basically have very little to do with.
Yeah, so we actually became more divided than inclusive because of the language that we chose. And you're actually saying something very interesting, like where we can sit at the intersection between diversity of thought and critical thought at the same time, and being able to actually take that and bring those together.
That's exactly right. And when we're overly focused on language or on what I call the search, the hunt for unconscious biases, then we tend to forget about the importance of how different people think. And how could a person think this way who was from that background? Guess what? They do. So get used to it, move on, and find a way to create a constructive relationship. I think it's gotten a little bollocked up. So on one hand, there's some issues with how it's been done, both in terms of the methodology, in terms of the language. On the other hand, there's a lot of political movement against it by people who frankly don't have to hire a whole lot of people. So that they're missing what the big issue is here for many companies.
We are. Plus, we're also going to see a very, very interesting interaction as to, you know, the talent mix and the pool mix is actually changing as well. So we're definitely seeing that in the demographics across different countries, especially in countries that actually don't have replacement population, right? You're going to actually see very, very senior, like, population shifts that are going to happen. Let's talk a little bit about women's leadership. this is a topic you've been passionate about for the last 35 years. Exactly. So what's changed? Let's go back. I don't know. I can't even think. In the 80s. Let's take the 80s maybe.
Not much was happening in the 80s. I'll tell you, I was there. Not much was happening. I've been very active in this field since 1988. So that's a while. It's pretty much longer than anybody else around who's doing this kind of work. And I've watched it change dramatically. I've watched women become much more confident. I've watched them develop much more solidarity with one another. Certainly. I've also watched them recognize the importance of building alliances with men and get ideas about how to do that, which of course, in turn, requires confidence. So I've watched this field change dramatically. And there have been, this is Disrupt TV show. So I was thinking about it and I thought there are a couple big disruptors. One was not much got changed until, say, starting in the mid-90s. One was all the research that was done, and this doesn't sound very exciting, but a lot of research was done showing the advantage to organizations of being able to attract and retain talented women, how it was better for teams, how teams made better decisions, how organizations cultures made better decisions, et cetera, how they operated in a more harmonious way, et cetera. So that had a big impact. But the two big sort of disruptor events that I saw were, number one, the 2008 global recession. That was a big deal. I remember I was at a huge conference, women's conference in Deauville, France, women from all over the world, every country possible was represented. They called it the Davos for women because women weren't in Davos then. But it was really interesting. And the economy was melting down even as we were there. And what a lot of women took away from it was, I listened to those guys when they said, no, we're doing things right. You just can't see it. When they didn't listen to my warnings, because a lot of women were in the role of Cassandras then, warning that, their organization, this is not a very good way of investing our investors' money, et cetera. And they weren't listened to. And they saw, okay, we actually knew what we were talking about. And some of these guys who were real big shots did not know. So we need to have more confidence, more trust in our gut, in our intuition. We cannot be cowed in the way we have been in the past. So that was a huge change that I saw happen then. And things kept unrolling, especially since that was very active. And of course, Me Too was also big. And that, I would say, played a particular role in building solidarity among women, because so many, even those who hadn't had egregious things happen to them, it was just a steady, slow drip of condescending expectations and suggestive comments that kind of, got to you after a while.
So what's changed? Like, who are the new idols, or who are the new people that we look up to? Like, based, let's take the 90s and versus where we were at now today. Like, are there shifts in terms of like who people like aspire to be?
I think people aspire to be leaders who are really, I'll speak for women, because that's who I talk to most of the time.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Women's leadership wise, like who do people aspire to be?
Gretchen Carlson is a fantastic example. She was a Fox, and now she has all kinds of media projects she's involved in. She was forced out of Fox because she, talked about what her experience had been in terms of sexual harassment. And she just landed on her feet in the most positive way. And a lot of women follow her. Also, a lot of women legal commentary, since we're in a time where people are talking a lot about legal issues. I think that's been a big thing. So it's people who've really been through an experience that's been painful and have come out the other end, and people who have great expertise in their area. It's not so much the so-and-so became a CEO type of orientation that was the idea in, for example, the 90s. That's not, we don't anymore just assume that anybody who's in a CEO position has the keys to the kingdom and the answers to everything.
Okay, so it's not the tech woman CEO that's leading the charge. It's the expert industry guru, someone that's gone in deep on a subject matter. What about influencers?
So. You mean influencers on social media?
Is there some place where people aspire to? Are there diplomats that people aspire to be? Political leaders that actually draw upon those leadership characteristics?
Well, I think that Justice Jackson has definitely been one of those influencers and one of those people who has inspired a lot of women across the board. You hear that all the time. I think that the Ursula von Leyen, big deal. And then especially the younger leaders like the Kaha, I'm not remembering her last name, who's the Prime Minister of Estonia. We are seeing such an emergence of leadership talent in Eastern Europe, in those countries. I think that that's been something that a lot of people are looking to feel inspired by and to take lessons away from and to learn how to be, you know, active citizens and contributors to the world, to their organizations, etc.
Yeah, I know Kaja Kallas is definitely someone people do look up to. Culture-wise, what's changed? Let's talk about the old Drucker's culture eats strategy for breakfast, famous quote, extended a little bit more by Mark Andreessen, software eats the world. But let's put it into the context of leadership. How do you see that applying to organizations today?
You know, I think it applies to organizations in the way it's always applied, Ray, which is that culture does eat strategy. I am in strong agreement with Peter Drucker on that. Does eat strategy. That means it is more important and more determinative of the long-term health and the sustainability of an organization and ultimately its creativity and ability to have an impact. Culture is what does that, but senior leaders are rewarded for strategy because the system we live in, and we all live in it, is very oriented toward short-term performance, medium-term performance. So it's very tough for leaders, as much as they may want to or as much as they may talk about it, to actually put culture first. There's something else, too, though, with culture. A culture, one of the big lessons for me of being in the whole field of leadership for almost 40 years now has been the extent to which a leader shapes a culture. It is so true, and we've all seen it. We've all worked in an organization that had a great culture. New CEO comes in, the culture is completely different within a year or two. So it's really determined by the leader. And it is so difficult for leaders to get any kind of information as to what the culture is actually like or how people experience it because people don't talk honestly. Years ago, before I was on this career, I was a corporate speechwriter, which is a lot of fun, I have to say. But when you're a corporate speechwriter, you know, it's hard because the guy always, you know, oh, I want to make 38 important points in this talk. Oh, really? That's going to be coherent. And so it's very tough to do because they've always got opinions and they're different than yours, but you're there to serve them. And often they're lousy speakers as well. But what used to infuriate me or make my job harder was I would be like, well, what was that about? Does anybody have any idea what that jackass said? Something like that. And then everybody would go up to him and say, wow, that was great. You really nailed it with that. And I said, don't tell him that. Don't tell him that. He'll never.
Don't encourage bad behavior. What's going on?
Bad speech for the rest of your lives. Is that really what you want? And it helped me understand something that I have watched. And I see people trying to deal with this. I see Marshall's, for example, Marshall Goldsmith's stakeholder-centered leadership, coaching, you know, which is where the coach tries to get everybody in the company to share what their actual impressions are of the leaders. Well, good luck with that. I've tried it. And I've been told, well, off the record, but, you know, here's what I, you know, here's what I want to say. They don't tell you. It's very difficult. So a leader who is actually interested in creating a positive and sustainable culture, not a culture that blows up the day after they leave or the year after they leave, really needs to find a number of people who will tell them the absolute truth on whatever it is. And those are going to be different people in different areas. But that's, I think, the most important thing for a leader who wants to have an impact, a positive impact that's sustainable on a culture. Because otherwise, he or she is just going to think that they are doing great. And as long as they have a strategy that brings about some shorter, medium term, you know, positive revenues, then they're not going to feel that that's contradicted. So that's tough. And I haven't seen a whole lot of progress on that one.
No, I haven't either. And I think that's going to be a tough one in general, right? Finding that right environment and getting that right culture. It's almost somewhere between a blend of art and science. And of course, you do really have to know where you want to take people. And so that truly is a leadership.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Sally, time has flown by. We really appreciate you being here and back again. So it's amazing. We can follow Sally at Sally, H-E-L-G-E-S-E-N on X or Twitter, but more importantly, catch her book. So if you haven't read her book yet, definitely read actually all her books. There's quite a number of books. So it's not just one, but check it out on Amazon. And thank you so much for being on the show and coming in from Seville.
Thank you, Ray. It's just been wonderful talking with you.
All right. Take care. Very, very cool. Well, as you can see, that leadership issue is definitely hot. It's not going away, but we're going to look at DEI and do it in a very different way. But we have another topic that's very, very interesting here. And we're going to go introduce each guest first. I'm going to read your bios. And then, of course, once we jump them there, we will then talk and jump into a discussion. So our dynamic duo here is Conrad Shaw and, of course, Scott Santens. And thank you for being here. I think it's a very, very hot topic, conversations that has been had for many, many years in different places. Conrad is the UBI trial manager and series co-creator of Bootstraps docuseries, co-founder of Commingle, co-founder of Income to Support All Foundation, and creator of the UBI calculator, if you haven't tested that out yet. Conrad Shaw is a research producer, writer, and activist in the UBI movement. He's a mechanical engineer turned filmmaker. In 2016, he launched into full-time UBI work when he teamed up with the now wife and partner, Dea Schlossberg, on a docuseries project called Bootstraps, for which he designed and managed the Bootstraps basic income experiment, delivering basic incomes of $1,000 per month to 22 Americans across 10 states for 2.5 years. Very interesting research. And field produced for the film production side of the project. Conrad also created the UBI calculator as a tool for the movement, wrote a couple dozen essays. And of course, he's done a lot more than that. Actually, he's become co-founder of Commingle, a startup company building a next-gen mutual ad platform designed along basic income principles. We'll talk a little bit about pharma later and how it can work. And of course, in 2003, he co-founded the Income to Support All ITSA Foundation. Thank you for being here. You can follow him on X at the UBI Guy. Welcome to the show, Conrad.
Thank you. Yeah. One quick correction. It's a mutual aid platform, not a mutual ad platform.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a mutual aid platform. Oh, yes. Sorry. Mutual aid platform. So I do need glasses. It's kind of happening one of these days. Scott Santens, welcome as well. Founder and president of Income to Support All Foundation. I was like, yeah, that's an interesting ad network. I'm Scott Santens. That's really funny. That's very funny. Well, Scott's been researching and advocating for the concept of unconditional universal basic income, or UBI, since 2013. I think Andrew Yang was talking about you for quite some time. One of those helped shape his thinking and an influencer. And really, of course, you've actually lived with a basic income floor via Patreon since 2015. So really popularizing that whole concept, living it, breathing it, evangelizing it, more importantly. And of course, you've been able to serve on the board of directors of the Gerald Huff Foundation for Humanity and the editor of Basic Income Today, a daily UBI news hub. And of course, you had a book that was called Let There Be Money. You can buy it on Amazon, of course, or listen to it, of course, if you haven't checked it out on the podcast platform. You can follow Scott at S-C-O-T-T-S-A-N-T-E-N-S, so on X. So welcome to the show, Scott.
Thanks, Ray.
So Well, this is a big debate because you're on with a free market capitalist. So this is going to be a fun conversation. Mm-hmm. And we have a little conversation about all the different arguments. And I think it's a very important piece to have different sets of ideas here. And so we'll start here by going with, let's start the discussion in terms of where you guys see this headed in general, because why are people talking about this? And especially in the age of AI.
Yeah, I guess just to start things off too by just making sure that everyone knows what basic income is, you know, since let's just set the definition. So it's a periodic cash payment unconditionally delivered to all without means test or work requirement on an individual basis. So, you know, when you respond to it, it's like a lot of people will say, oh, that's communism or whatever. And it's like, no, it's very capitalistic, the supporters of Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. But you also have like communists and socialists saying like, no, that's a terrible idea because it saves capitalism. And, you know, so it's funny that there's both sides can be both for and against this topic. There really is a lot of arguments for it. And most recently, the discussion is mainly around technology, around the future of technology and automation, AI, robots, the impact that'll have on the labor markets. And, you know, this concern that anyone could lose their job, that wages could go down, just the general insecurity of what's going to happen and nobody really knows. So, you know, this concept of having this foundational floor underneath everybody is something that can really create this strong sense of security and also make sure that people can continue spending as consumers in markets in the instance that, in any instance, but especially in the instance that automation through robots and AI continues to somehow erode wages and lower those. Basic income can be seen as this mechanism that can actually get us through this potentially very disruptive time. And of course, there's other reasons for it too. Even like climate change is going to be very disruptive, and basic income is something that actually can enable more climate adaptation, enable fleeing from various climate crises, and enable to rebuild after some kind of crisis happens. There's just a lot of great arguments for it, and you know, I'm happy to get into the details.
I'd like to chime in a little more too about the free market capitalism bit, because it's often they're situated or presented as contrary ideas, which I fundamentally think is a misunderstanding. To me, a free market capitalism can only function in the way that it's conceived and presented with one competition. So that requires some level of regulation so we don't have monopoly. And this is true regardless of whether or not we have UBI. This is true in and of itself. But the other thing a lot of people forget that it requires is non-domination. So, for example, take the labor market. What's presented often is that people are paid what they're worth through the negotiating process, but that's not really what happens. People are paid as little as the employers can get away with paying them based on the fact that there is the presence of desperation in a market. So if you have a population of people that need to take something desperately, they're going to take something desperately, and that drives down wages. I know when I was an engineer out of school, Lockheed was charging $150 or $200 an hour for my services and giving me $30. So I know that it wasn't 70% going to overhead. It was more, one, I was out of school, so there's, I have to pay my dues, but also there's a whole market of people who will take 30. So if I don't get any job. So one thing a basic income does is allows people at a very fundamental level to know that they're okay, that they can live at some level of dignity so that they can approach these negotiations and fight for more of what they believe their true value is rather than what they have to take.
Let me insert a free market conversation here, since I'm sure you debate these all the time. But the notion is that, you know, you will eventually, get to a point where we're in a global workspace and in a global workforce, right? We're seeing margin compression in almost every part of the world. So I'll give you an example. Like say payments and financial services today. The West is really expensive. We take 1% of transactions. But in India, what they've done is they've managed to take that entire industry and do transactions at pennies per transaction. But what the result is, they've taken the unbanked and made them all banked. If that were to come into the West, what would happen is there's no way I would be able to afford to pay you X, Y, and Z. Like, I couldn't give you even $50 an hour to actually work at a Western bank because the rest of the market has just collapsed, right? And so there are forces that come from free market that would actually change that dynamic. And so if we're operating at $50 an hour, India's operating at $10 an hour, transaction payments have gone from, you know, $2 to $3 a payment to like pennies. The market economics won't even support the basic income. Like, what do you do in those kind of situations?
I'm going to throw this one to Scott.
Well, yeah. So when we're talking about automation, you know, part of this discussion about automation too is about globalization, and you know, these things go together. Where it's technology that actually really enabled globalization to take place as it has, and so even when we're talking about the future of AI, the future of robots, and this kind of like, you know, what happens in the future. I like to point out that what we've been witnessing has been happening for decades. Like, we have been looking at a transforming labor market worldwide. And you can, you know, rightly point out that there has been, you know, compression such that inequality between countries has reduced, which I think a lot of people would argue is a good thing. But then also as another result of this is you've seen inequality within countries increase. And you've seen these stagnant wages, you know, in the U.S., it's in essentially stagnant wages for decades now, since the 70s, where there was this great decoupling, is what it's referred to. And essentially $50 trillion of economic growth flowed to the top 1%, and the workers were left out of this. And so I think that part of this discussion should be, you know, it appears that the mechanism of wages has broken down. And this partly is because of the globalization of the labor market. And in which case, how do you actually share the overall productivity growth that used to be shared via wages and no longer is? And I think that mechanism needs to be a basic income and should be seen as a dividend. Like, this dividend is something that is made possible through the success of, you know, the corporation that is the United States. And as any successful corporation should do, should issue dividends to its stockholders, and we the citizens are stockholders. And when it comes to, you know, technology too, we created the data. It was our data that it has enabled AI to, you know, become what it is. It's public investments in technology that has brought the hardware to where it is. And I think people should recognize it that way and see it that way. And we could totally do that. It's very doable from the national perspective, being able to just issue this dividend. And there's a lot of different choices we can make about, like, you know, which taxes to raise and which reforms to make, which subsidies to reform, which welfare programs to reform. But I would argue that this is something that's very important to do, not just as like an adaptation to future dangers of automation, but because of what we've been witnessing for decades.
No, it's an interesting point, but wouldn't AI and automation give you a catalyst towards your argument? Right, where people, because now that we got two things, we got population decline, right? We're going to see the peak and then the drop down. Every Western democracy and any kind of Western country basically is going to experience a population inverted pyramid. You know, China's going to lead the charge because they're in that space. Japan's a good example of where we are in the future. And that's going to accelerate the creation of automation and robots and other things. How do you get the policy right so you have the right balance between too much capacity, not enough capacity, people without purpose, people being able to pursue their purpose? Like, does that happen in policy, or are there market dynamics that could make that happen? Maybe I'm asking the wrong question and you don't have to be polite.
That's good. It's a good discussion.
I think a lot about the design of the things, and I come at it from more of an engineering design perspective, where imagining we're going to get it right the first time, or especially setting it at an arbitrary number that we have to like renegotiate all the time, are mistakes. I think with something so fluid as social policy in the context of ever-changing technology, we have to imagine it's going to be an optimization game and an adapting game. I think the most important part is the mechanism of getting a floor of income to everyone, and we can continually measure productivity, we can measure cost of living, and we can measure impacts and outcomes of what we do and optimize based from there to find the appropriate equilibrium.
But when you get a universal basic income, do you lose your freedoms, right? Because it might be social policy that says, hey, you know, because we're going to know it's going to be implemented differently in every country, right? It's going to be different places. In some countries, it's like, well, you have to have a good social credit score. And if you have that, maybe we'll give you the universal basic income.
That's not a universal basic income by the basic definition. This does come up a lot. And it is a concern, like with any idea, communism, capitalism, whatever, if they're corrupted by not the idea, then they become far worse. So if it is not universal and unconditional, meaning the government has no say over whether or not you get it and how much you get and what you need to do for it, if it's not specifically untargeted and unconditional, then it isn't the policy we're talking about. So the real question is, how do we make sure it is a UBI and remains a UBI as something that the government is only allowed to really act as a pass-through for this income? One way to see it is it's sort of a shrinkage of government responsibility and power. It's a deputizing of every single citizen to take their certain chunk of national prosperity and decide how to spend it themselves.
But how do you determine what's too much or too little, right? I take the state of Oregon, which offered free healthcare, and certain procedures were on a list, and sometimes they moved up or down depending on the budget or where people were, right? Like, how do you know what's enough? Or let's say people got greedy and decided to give everybody a UBI that wasn't a UBI, that was a little bit more, or people got stingy and went the other direction. Like, how do you correct for something like that?
Yeah, something I like to point to is the fact that the closest thing in operation to a universal basic income anywhere has been existing in Alaska since 1982 with their fully annual dividend. And so it's around $1,000, $2,000, it can be much more than that too, on an annual basis for over 40 years.
Yep.
And it's a great example to look at what is the impact of that. And so, you know, one of the impacts of that, a study was done to see what is the impact on employment. And it found that there was no increase or decrease on full-time employment, but it increased part-time employment by 17%. So overall, there was this increase in employment thanks to this additional income. And part of that was, you know, it helped fuel small businesses, it helped spending, and then that led to job creation, which enabled people who were looking for jobs to take those jobs. That's just one of those impacts. But another is this kind of political impact. So, you know, the question is, do people in Alaska, are they somehow, you know, more controlled by other states? Are they somehow like less independent by having this dividend? And, you know, I would bet that if you were to talk to, you know, 10 Alaskans, that none of them would say that they feel dependent or somehow less free because of having this dividend, because the state does not have any stipulations on it. It doesn't say you have to work in order to get it. You get it because you're a resident, and you know you do not. It's cash. It's not like some kind of voucher scheme or something. They would not accept something like that. And part of the strength of it is it's fully universal, and so that also helps feed into, you know, what can keep something unconditional is that if it's fully universal, then everybody has their skin in the game. And they vote. So part of the things in Alaska is that people do vote in higher numbers. And we see this with seniors too, with Social Security, like gives them a reason to vote. And then that makes them a more powerful, you know, voting bloc. So it's kind of like, it's interesting how people can be concerned about this kind of what government will do when you look at those populations like seniors and Social Security and see that they're actually greatly more empowered to the point where politicians appeal to them and want to like make them happy because they're worried about what happened if seniors turn against them.
I'd also love to speak a little to your strategic question. Mm-hmm. So about finding the right level. And this is the thing you mentioned that I did, the UBI calculator, it's ubicalculator.com, was an attempt to kind of get everyone to be a little more honest, be both pro and con, because a lot of people don't really understand what's real in the economy, what's available, what levers we can pull, and what the consequences are of those things, both macroeconomically and microeconomically. If we give everyone $50,000 a year, does that actually cause a great withdrawal from the workplace? If we give everyone, you know, $50 a year, does it make any difference and discredit the idea? So that was an example of like different ways we could fund it and what it might mean. Strategically for me, I think the way to approach it is remember that the most important part of the idea is the universality of it, the mechanism of everyone getting it, regardless of the size. I would start at a level that I feel confident is not going to negatively impact the economy potentially in ways we don't expect. So the poverty line or below is where I usually start. I shoot for poverty line. I don't think anyone's going to stop working when they're making poverty line. And then I would measure the outcomes and find a way to strategically peg it to a smart moving target, like a percentage of GDP or a percentage of per capita average income, so that as you know, there's a rising tide. As the country is more prosperous, we do better. And as the country has hard times, we're not robbing Peter to pay Paul. So that we're not having, you know, the minimum wage argument we're having forever and ever and ever of like, it needs to be this. And actually, no, now it needs to be this because we haven't changed it for 20 years. Have it set to something that sort of automatically grows with where the country's at.
So you want a dynamic formula is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
So, okay. One of my good friends, a guy named Richie Atwaru, was talking about the 31st human right, having your personal, like your data, your genomics, your all that information and insights that belong to you, and making that a property right. And he's using an example that was in the pharmaceutical industry. Like if you had a de-anonymized record in healthcare, like pharmaceutical companies would love it. They'd be willing to pay up to $600 to $800 a de-anonymized record for a clinical trial. And it doesn't impact, I mean, it's pretty interesting because healthcare doesn't discriminate. If you got a disease, you can actually pop it up. And so if the data was actually owned by you and you could actually, you know, volunteer the data, put it towards, you know, American Cancer Society if you want, or you could actually sell it to a pharmaceutical and they would seek your permission, you could easily get $600 to $800 per pharmaceutical company, which could be four pharmaceutical companies researching a drug that could actually fund your UBI, for example, right?
That's because that's an example of one good funding source. I mean, you could do carbon tax, you can do regular data taxes about, you know, your preferences, like the stuff that's being collected by Facebook. You could do wealth taxes, corporate taxes, income taxes. These are all value-based decisions. Another reason I created the calculator was to sort of eventually be able to let people vote their values and say, how do we want to pay for it as well? Like, what do we morally believe in?
Well, I was trying to find a more free market approach to it to get there. But take the Alaskan, like the Alaskan dividend, the fund, right? It's for minerals in the state. And when we look at the data, have we seen more people move to Alaska so they could get that? I don't think that has changed, but, you know, there hasn't been an inflow of people moving into Alaska to collect the dividend because the number isn't that high.
I bet a few people have.
People have tried to game it.
It hasn't been a big game changer. If you had a more robust UBI in one specific location, there's definitely the concern that, you know, you need some sort of way of proving residence or something. Like if you had a $12,000 per person per year UBI in some town in the you might see people kind of be like, I might move there. So that is a consideration when you're setting up a policy in terms of borders.
Well, I just want to chime in here too. First of all, when it comes to trying to figure out some kind of private market model for base income, that is a very interesting question. And when it comes to something, you know, like a data dividend of some kind, you know, I like that any kind of setup where a company is paying, you know, us for our data, I think is better than it not doing that. So that's great.
Oh, sure, data. We should own it, right?
Yeah, I don't think it substitutes a basic income. I think it is very complementary. But I do think that this is also a good opportunity to get into what the Commingle Project is looking
to
do.
Let's go to the research that you guys did too.
Yeah. There's two questions. So the first time Commingle can get into, you know, what is like an option for a private mechanism for a non-governmental model of a small basic income. And I think Bootstraps also answered one of your early questions as far as like how do you, you know, continue to seek purpose with basic income and say like, you know, what happens during this pilot when people had it? What do we generally see as a result of these pilots?
Yeah, the purpose behind both these projects our theory of change and everything is experiential, and we wanted to answer the two big questions that people have about UBI. One is always the like how is it done? You know, where's the money coming from? What's the mechanism? And that's sort of, we want to answer that experiential rather than intellectually. So we're building a model that actually functions as a governmental model, but on a voluntary basis. So it's like a self-selected nation where everyone pays voluntary income tax toward a pot that gets divvied every week in equal share to everyone. And it's an elegant way to make sure everyone in that joins the community is always guaranteed some floor of income every single week. And when you do that, it answers a lot of the questions experientially about the mechanism that tend to confuse people. Like, why would I give Bill Gates $1,000 a month? It's like, well, you give everyone a starting floor of $1,000 a month, but the way you would fund it would end up costing Bill Gates an extra, you know, some millions of dollars. So he ends up being a net contributor to the program. The reason you give it to everyone up front first is because it allows you to take an end run around the enormous bureaucratic burden and stigma and waste of missing people and collect the money back on the back end in taxes. So that's the mechanistic side. The deeper question everyone has when you get through the understanding of how it works is, should we do it? Can we trust people? And I think a lot of that is based in a perception of people rooted in the world in which we live, a world that makes that fosters scarcity and competition and isolation and othering of people. So we wanted to answer that question, like, should we trust people? Can we trust people with just cash with no oversight? Like, is that a good idea?
We saw that in the pandemic.
The human nature question. We should discuss that a little bit. But the point of our docuseries was to just experiment with that and say, we're going to give these people money. We're going to embrace scary stories, and from homeless to middle class, people with some drug addiction histories, and just see what happens, you know, and then people that are like living model lives, you know, just see what happens in everyone's circumstance and let people come to their own conclusions. So with the pandemic, I'm curious where you're going to go with this. I think we should clarify the difference between things like the stimulus checks and unemployment checks. The stimulus checks were very much like one-off UBI payments. The unemployment checks were confused and conflated with UBI, but they're actually functionally the opposite.
They're the opposite. I agree with you. Basic. No, they were the opposite. Yeah. No, the stimulus checks actually, I mean, look, when I saw the stimulus checks go up, I literally bet on Las Vegas casinos. All the money went into Las Vegas.
All the money went into Las Vegas. I don't think data backs that up. I gotta be honest with you.
Las Vegas experiences,
travel, stimulus checks, and the child tax credit ended up cutting poverty in half while they were happening. Yeah. I think that's what happened.
Travel wasn't even an option, really. You know, especially that first stimulus check. You know, the first stimulus check when that came out right the heart of the pandemic and the shutdowns. When you know that was really a lifesaver.
I want to go to the research. I want to go to the research. Tell me the stories. What did you guys discover? So I think that's the important piece.
The stories. Let's talk about what's an issue you care about, because we pick stories to cover all kinds of issues, like whether it's climate or addiction, or like, just give me one that's.
Well, I mean, did UBI help? I mean, how would UBI help someone who is on recovery, for example, in addiction?
We have a story like that, and we picked them exactly for this reason. And she was in a very difficult place. She was working three jobs. One of them as a strip dancer, one of them as a work from home, helping people get autistic people get their coverage. She had a lot of different jobs, and she was robbing Peter to pay Paul. She was about to lose the house her parents had got her or had left her when they died. And she was on the edge. She'd been sober for 3 years, but was feeling herself falling back into it. The way she described the basic income was knowing that drinking, addiction, things like that are ways to check out when you don't see a path forward. And the second she started getting that basic income, she described feeling the ability to check back in, feeling those urges dramatically reduced, being able to go to a bar with friends and say, no, thanks, I'll have water, being able to, well, her story was, she's still, it's funny, she's one of the ones who's most resistant to the idea still. She's very traumatized and thinks this is maybe something we shouldn't give to people with an addiction history. And when we say to her, you know, that's why we picked you, because a lot of people would feel that way about you. And you saved your house, you got a better job, you found love, you like, you traveled.
Was this $1,000 more a month or $1,000 a year?
$1,000 a month. So our specific program was meant to set the floor at least the poverty line for any household. And we treated it as households, but given to individuals within each household. So $1,000 per month per adult and $333 per month per child would ensure that every household was at least at the poverty line, and that each individual in the household had their own check coming in. So if something happened, there was no financial abuse preventing people from being free.
So you could take this, and let's take the scenario where, I mean, and maybe I can make the argument. You can tell me maybe it's not true. So I just want to check. But the argument that even today, like, I mean, there's a certain percentage that pay taxes, certain percentage that do not pay taxes, right? In one effect, they're subsidized. If you look at urgent care or emergency care services, you know, some people are receiving that SNAP assistance along the way. I mean, don't those all add up to some similar levels of UBI? Would you get rid of all that and then replace it with UBI, or would you still keep those programs?
They add up theoretically to similar levels of money, but they're like unemployment, they are the opposite of UBI. So anything that has an arbitrary cliff in which it's taken away creates a ceiling over poverty, a direct work disincentive, a direct disincentive to contribute, whether you're talking about disability payments or whatever. It says you have to save your basic level of security that's coming in through these. You're not allowed to pursue a higher level of achievement and security through these other means. So it traps people, whereas UBI provides a floor beneath all of these things. And what you see in those circumstances, and what we saw with all of our 11 stories to a degree that shocked me, you know, we came in not to advocate, but to just study, was just how quickly people, once they gained the trust that this was going to keep happening and they knew for how long, just attacked their aspirations, their hurdles. They took a deep interest in their finances. This was like a light at the end of the tunnel that said, you know, walk toward it. And it was pretty breathtaking, actually, to see.
I'll add too that when it comes to these questions like replacement of programs like SNAP and stuff, like, it is a good way to look at this as being, there are a lot of things that we already do that we can replace with basic income. And you know, those like TANF, SNAP, these kind of programs, I think that they definitely can be replaced by basic income. But then there's also a lot of tax expenditures. We do over $1.5 trillion a year in tax expenditures. These are these tax subsidies. It's, you know, we all enjoy the standard deduction. You know, that is a tax subsidy, and we can do a basic income instead of the standard deduction. We can do it instead of the EITC, and there's a, you know, home mortgage.
A huge number when we add all these up, right?
Yeah, like, right. It's very big. So those are a lot of things that you could actually replace. And in doing so, then, yeah, you have to worry less about like what additional taxes you have to come up with. You have to worry less about what inflationary impact there could be, because you are essentially turning like one thing into another thing.
A thing that I learned when I was doing the UBI calculator that I wanted to make sure people on the pro side understood is, in this country, we vastly underfund social support. So just turning welfare programs into UBI would underfund it, and it would end up hurting people who are getting some support by splitting too little support across too many people. In, say, a Nordic country, they have a much more robust social program, so they could maybe switch it directly over to UBI and benefit that way.
Got it.
We need to put more into it in general. But one thing that we get in trouble with on the left specifically, or they get angry with us on the left, is this idea of touching the third rail of like replacing welfare. And one thing I'm always trying to get across is that welfare is arguably better than nothing for people who are getting it. But in the presence of a better program, like a universal basic income, we have to acknowledge that welfare actually it sucks. It's a very bad program. It's punitive. It's inefficient. And in the presence of something better, it is actually something that hurts people and drags us down. And it should be replaced. it's not enough by itself to replace it to fund the thing. But we should touch that third rail and really get that out in the open that, like, if we can replace it with something better and something solid, a floor, we should.
I mean, but we're averaging only 60% of U.S. households actually paid income tax. Think about that. I mean, they're really built-in subsidy right there.
Well, think about the fact that it's like 50 or 60% of U.S. households don't have enough income to pay for a $500 or $1,000 emergency. I don't know what the latest stat is, but these are the households that are living paycheck to paycheck. And I think it largely points to the imbalances that make it not as much a free market. That there's a great Time article that sort of references what Scott was talking about before, how over the past 50 years, $50 trillion of added productivity has gone to the owner class. And it's essentially been skimmed off the top of everything we all should have been paid that entire time. And this is why we can't afford things, along with certain industries where the costs have inflated ridiculously.
And I'm sure you guys are well aware of the UNDP study on universal basic income, looking at China, right? If they were ready to do something like that or able to do that. It's a very interesting study that said that they hadn't spent enough expenditures on social programs back to where you were in the US to be able to fund that. It'd be a net negative for them tremendously, I think. I think that was the conclusion.
Maybe compared to net cost, compared to what they're spending now, but there's another one, and Scott, I'm sure, has much better like figures on this. But one thing that's ignored often is both the tremendous cost of poverty from crime and hospitalization and extra police and in general, to the tremendous opportunity cost of anyone with good idea, passion, and the drive to bring something new that doesn't have the risk tolerance and has to, work a low-end job just to get by. And we're costing ourselves with allowing this level of economic insecurity, we're costing ourselves far more than the cost of providing a basic income. And I would imagine that's true in China as well.
I think the real question is, when can we trot out Gene Roddenberry? I'm serious. I want to know how we got from here to the Star Trek economy.
Well,
the Star Trek economy is UBI, if you think about it.
We're so sick, at least I can speak for myself, of the political process being so mired in everything that it's mired in, and polarization and politicization. Commingle is an attempt to take a very strong step in that direction, using the power of the internet, the private sector, to scale something up significantly. We're trying to create the first permanent basic income ever, essentially, funded as a governmental model, but through a private effort. And the goal is to have 100,000 people getting a basic income by the end of 2025 and scale it from there. If we create, instead of a social network for people to interact with each other and generate ad revenue for some corporation, but instead we create more of a solidarity network for people to both connect with each other, but also support each other and utilize the exponential potential of the internet and network models, we can take a lot of very large leaps ahead without getting mired in the political and polarizing mess that we find everything else in right now.
I mean, it's very hard for anything to agree. I can't even believe we agreed on a TikTok ban. It's probably the only bipartisan legislation you'll see all year. I mean it's kind of crazy.
I just want to add, when it comes to Star Trek, I mean, this is something that I really feel is important, where that's the future. That I've always felt the future is that, to me, growing up, that is just how I thought things were going to go and should be going, a very like optimistic vision. And lately it's been a much more pessimistic vision. You see a lot of Hunger Games, kind of things, dystopian visions. And I think basic income is something that can really even just turn things around from this mental perspective of, if things can be better and how to get there, from just being really this element of trust. And we have a society built on distrust. And as long as we do that, it's really hard to go towards this Star Trek future, because then, you automate a bunch of stuff and you're like, no, well, we can't just give out money to people and that's wrong. Well, to, you know, train them to do this or that. And, oh, I guess they can't do that. We'll house them in these projects and stuff and just give them food because we can't give them money. And it's all just a very like dystopian vision. But, you know, when it comes to when you decouple income from work, then, you know, that's something that really scares people. Like, oh, well, you know, you have to work to eat. But, you know, in Star Trek, that wasn't about. In Star Trek, you were talking about, well, you know, what is it that you want to do? Right.
Yeah, you're pursuing your ideas, your dreams. You had purpose.
But
yeah,
everybody wants to matter. And that's something people don't give enough attention to the, or don't understand, really.
I mean, the underlying premise is that humans are, I mean, many people say the underlying premise is that humans are lazy. And with the right disincentives, they will do those. With the right incentives, they may move in certain direction. But the question is, like, how do you help them find purpose, right? Which is a very, very different thing. And how do you tell who's good or bad in that model?
I think that the best way to help someone find purpose is to free them up to seek their own purpose. I think the biggest takeaway I have from spending 3 years with people going through a basic income is that everybody wants purpose. Everyone wants to find their own purpose. I don't know what happens when AI is better than us at everything. We'll have to address that as it comes. But rather than helping someone find their purpose from a top-down approach, you give them power. You know, UBI is basically power to the people because cash is power. You give them power and they will seek that purpose.
Conrad with the last word. So Conrad Shaw, UBI trial manager and series co-creator of Bootstraps Discussions, co-founder of Comingo, co-founder of Income to Support All Foundation, and creator of the UBI calculator. Check it out. And Scott Santins, founder and the president of Income to Support All Foundation. You can follow him at the UBI guy and at Scott Santins, S-A-N-T-E-N-S. So thank you so much for being on the show. Happy Friday. And thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Happy Friday.
Look forward to a bigger discussion. Let's create a convention on this. All right. Well, everybody, welcome. We're going to have our next show and the next episode is coming up. And that episode is episode number 363. We have Professor Ilya Strobilov, founder of the Venture Capital Initiative at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, GSB, and one of the foremost academic experts on venture capital and the co-author of The Venture Mindset. Michael Norton, the author of The Ritual Effect, From Habit to Ritual, Harness the Surprising Power of Everyday Actions. Talk a little bit more about the behavioral science business. And of course, you can catch us next week. So if it's Friday, it's Disrupt TV. Catch us 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern every Friday. And of course, our co-host, Vala Ashram, will be back. So thanks, everybody, and have an amazing Friday.